Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, global alarm around COVID-19, also known as the new coronavirus. How did it begin? How dangerous is it? What needs to be done now to protect public health? With us is Paul Hunter. He's a professor of health protection at the Norwich School of Medicine at the University of East Anglia in the UK. He's the author of Can Economic Indicators Predict Infectious Disease Spread? A cross-country panel analysis of 13 European countries, and also Misinformation Making a Disease Outbreak Worse, Outcomes Compared for Influenza, Monkeypox, and Norovirus. So welcome to the Scholar Circle, Paul Hunter. It is great to have you here with us.
It's a pleasure.
I thought we should start perhaps at the beginning of this. Can we understand what exactly happened with this virus called both coronavirus and COVID-19 from its origins to now?
Well, we are pretty sure how it started. The virus itself comes it's one of many coronaviruses that are circulating in different bat populations. And so the virus that is now causing such a problem in the world originally came from a bat. It probably didn't jump straight from the bat into humans. It probably infected another mammal first. Possibly whilst that mammal, and maybe the bat as well, was being transported illegally into China. For sale in the markets. And the stress of transporting these animals is such that the animals get very stressed and they are more susceptible to the virus. So probably the intermediate host, the other mammal, got really quite poorly and the virus increased to large numbers. And then while it was being slaughtered or butchered in China, it infected a number of people.
Well, that would give us sort of an indication that there are more of these possible to get.
Oh, absolutely. There are a large number of coronaviruses in bats, and I'm sure all of them are queuing up to have their day in the sun in the human population.
I wonder then if we might need to distinguish this particular one from others that we, you know, that we face regularly. As you said, there are many coronaviruses. I understand some of them are not really dangerous at all.
Right. Yeah. Yes. They tend to be two different genera of coronaviruses. There are alpha coronaviruses, which are pretty much the ones that cause the common cold, that have been circulating in amongst human populations for ever and don't really cause that much harm other than, you know, a bad cold. And then there's the beta coronaviruses, of which there are three types. There's SARS, which came out in 2002-2003. There's MERS, which is Middle Eastern Respiratory Virus, which has been around since about 2012 and still occasionally causes infections, but not anywhere near the same frequency as SARS and especially COVID-19. And now we've got COVID-19. COVID-19 is closest to SARS virus than it is to the MERS virus.
So did we learn enough from MERS and SARS in terms of how to manage human populations that we can understand what needs to happen with COVID-19?
Right. I would have been a lot more positive about answering that question a month ago, when pretty much we thought it was going to follow the same sort of trajectory as SARS and behave quite like SARS. Although perhaps given that the many more cases we were seeing at the time, we should have been a little bit more prompt in realizing that it wasn't behaving quite like SARS. Certainly, we know a lot from SARS about how these sorts of viruses are spread from person to person, essentially by droplet spread, which is sort of when people cough or sneeze and they're close to you, or that coughs and sneezes lands on work surfaces that you then touch and put in your mouth. And so, yes, we know that from SARS. The differences, however, are some of them are quite striking. One is that it's not as severe an illness as SARS, and it seems to take longer. A lot more people have very mild symptoms compared to SARS. 80% of people that we know about have very mild illness, and there's undoubtedly a large number of cases of people who are infected that we don't know about, that probably either have no symptoms whatsoever or have such a mild illness that they don't bother seeking healthcare.
So that would give an indication that it could be like a more mild virus, except for people who might be compromised or whose immune systems can't.
Yes. I mean, in general, the people who get the severe disease and indeed the people who die are people who are over 65 or have some other disease, diabetes, cancer, chronic lung disease. But that doesn't mean to say that otherwise healthy younger people don't get severe disease. We saw the sad case of the Chinese ophthalmologist who I believe was in his early 30s when he died. But we think that possibly he was particularly severe because he'd had such a high exposure to a lot of patients with the infection. And of course, if you're an ophthalmologist, you really get in your patients' faces in a way that other doctors don't, perhaps.
So repeated exposure might make somebody more vulnerable.
Possibly, yes. If it's over a short period of time and they have a very high exposure rate, that's certainly possible. I think it's more to do with the amount of virus that you take in rather than, you know, the frequency of it.
It also makes me wonder, separate from these new viruses or extensions of variations of viruses, it makes me wonder also about these superbugs that are antibiotic resistant and why some people are able to fight them and other people are not able to fight them, because they've said similar things. For example, with MRSA, you know, people who have that can normally be carriers and go on with their lives and be fine, but other people cannot fight it.
Yeah, it's not quite the same, because with these antimicrobial resistant organisms, what we can become colonized with them, and many of us are colonized, and they can sit there quite happily until we have an injury or some surgery or whatever, that actually they then infect the wound, and you then try antibiotics, and the antibiotics fail. So it's not quite the same, but you're quite right. I mean, the vast majority of us who would pick up an antibiotic resistant organism would have no problems. Perhaps never. Perhaps no problems for a year or so. But perhaps if we then say developed a urinary tract infection a year later, we might actually get the infection with that same organism.
So there's been a lot of talk around containment with the virus, mm-hmm. with COVID-19.
Yes.
Just to go back to that, whether or not it can be contained. And you had said, I think in another interview, that you'd sort of lost faith in that possibility. What does that mean?
Well, I don't think I've lost faith in it. I think I think we're getting beyond the point that may no longer be sufficient. When you've got small numbers of cases, you can go to quite extraordinary lengths to isolate them so that they don't spread the infection. You can nurse them in special high consequence infectious disease units so that you can be really sure that the people nursing them know how to prevent infections, keep themselves safe, and make sure that that patient doesn't spread the infection to anybody else. That only works when you've got relatively small numbers of cases, because I don't know off the top of my head how many of these beds we have in the UK, but it can't be many more than 20 or 30 or something like that. If you had a couple of hundred cases, then we wouldn't be able to use those sort of beds. We'd have run out of them. And so we'd have to move to different strategies for protecting people. But if And when we start seeing the infection spreading within the community, the wider community, then just isolating people that are infectious, that are ill, and that you know is positive, you're going to miss so many, and it will no longer really be an effective way of controlling the spread. And in fact, once it is spreading like that in the community, there's very little that you can do to stop the overall epidemic spread. And then you change your strategy from containment of cases to a more protective containment, where you try and actually keep particularly vulnerable people away from risk. So, for example, you might, in that context, wish to stop people visiting nursing homes and for the elderly care and that sort of thing.
And then, of course, there's the possibility of a vaccine being developed. I understand there is something being developed. Do you know about this?
Yeah, well, as I understand it, there are four decent vaccine candidates that are all pretty much close to being used in clinical trials. The problem with the vaccine is that it's these days it's actually very easy to make one, and we've got coronavirus vaccines already that for SARS we've never had to use them, but we've got a vaccine that seems to be effective for SARS. But with a new vaccine, you've first got to produce it, which is these days is the easy part. You've then got to prove that it's safe in people, that you don't give it to people and they then start getting other illnesses or particularly severe reactions to it. So you have to prove it's safe. And then you have to prove it's effective in terms of generating the immunity that you want. All that takes time. So at the very earliest that we will have a vaccine is probably the end of this year, but more likely into early next year.
Is it possible at all that people who do get exposed but don't have the symptoms are actually developing the immune system already?
Yes, the immunity to the virus. Oh, absolutely. I think if you get the infection and you don't get ill, it's because to a large extent you've developed an immunity to it. And so, yes, the big question, though, with these people is whether they're infectious to others. And there's some evidence that they possibly are, but other evidence has contradicted that. So certainly, again, about a month ago, I would have said that, you know, that these people are probably not infectious, but I'm less confident now. But that doesn't mean to say that I think that's a major source of that they are a major source of transmission, but you know, you don't need them to be that. You just need, you know, one or two people causing an infection in a population that's not been exposed to it so far, and then they develop the illness.
So that would also then pertain to people who need to travel in an enclosed airplane. Explain that to us.
Certainly with SARS, we were aware with SARS that there was a number of episodes where people were infected whilst they were travelling. And there was one particular super spreader event associated with an aeroplane where the person spread the infection around several people on board. Now, the view is that if you are infectious with this virus, then you would probably only spread it to people sitting in the row in front of you and the row in front of them and possibly the people in the two rows behind. And that is, and given how we know that the disease is spread, that is by droplets, that is probably a reasonably good estimate, really. The problem is that in that one of those outbreaks, people got infected in several parts of the plane. And other people have argued about this. Some have said, well, you know, we don't know for certain that they'd got their infection on the plane. Maybe they'd got the infection somewhere else, etc. So we can't But other people, and I actually tend to, I tend to believe this particular explanation. I think some of those people that weren't actually sitting close to the index case were probably maybe stood next to him in the queue waiting to board aeroplanes, because I'm sure you've taken quite a few air flights in your career, and you do tend to stand around in a crowd waiting to board the aeroplane for sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes longer, and which is a time that you might actually then be spreading the infection.
So there's also been a suggestion that warmer weather will help tamp down the virus.
Yeah. Well, we don't know this for certain, because clearly, you know, it's only been going since December. But when you look at other infections, particularly influenza, that are spread in roughly the same way, influenza tends to cause problems in winter. In the Northern Hemisphere, it's November, December, January, February, March. And the rest of the year, you still see the occasional case, but it's of influenza, but it's substantially less frequent. You know, it's unusual, but it's not unheard of. In SARS, what happened was that we had it, it lasted 8 months and then sort of disappeared in August. So it came at around about the same time and then disappeared. It's in my view, not random that actually even now it was December that this virus seemed to start causing problems. And I expect it to decline as summer comes. Whether it will go away completely, I don't know. And whether it comes back again next year, I don't know. I suspect it will come back next winter, but I don't know for certain. And the reasons for this, there are many reasons for this, and we don't totally know why this is the case, but things like during the summer, schools are out, school holidays. During the summer, it's warmer. People spend more of their time outdoors and less of their time cramped indoors with the windows with lots of people around them. And because they, take their leisure activities out of doors rather than indoors in the summer. So, and both of those are reasonable explanations for that. But that again, whether this indeed happens with this or not, we will have to wait and see. But I suspect it will decline. My guess is it will decline in the summer to and then perhaps appear again November, December.
The last thing I'd really like to cover with you, since you've got some limited time today, is around misinformation and the costs of misinformation on public health, which I think some of your research has suggested it could be deadly.
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah. I mean, we published a couple of papers on this, actually, and it's quite funny. We wanted to do a bigger research project, but we didn't get the funding to support this. And so what we did is we did a couple of small trial papers. So, you know, we thought, well, we'll do what we can do in the time that we've got available, and we'll publish them. And okay, it's not going to be that, they won't be necessarily be that well taken up, but you know, at least we've flagged that this is something that we're interested in. And by chance, the last of the two was published about a week or so ago, after 2 days after the Director General of the World Health Organization complained about misinformation. Our study was theoretical, but we were using data that was available in the literature. For example, in the West African Ebola epidemic, there was a study that showed that if you believed in the conspiracy theories about Ebola, then you were less likely to undertake safe funeral practices, and therefore you were more likely to catch Ebola and die. So, yeah, these things can have and do have serious, you know, misinformation about what you need to do or not need to do can have serious implications on people increasing their risk of infection. And, there has, I gather, been a lot of misinformation around this particular epidemic, some suggesting that it's all, you know, to do with it's a genetically engineered virus or whatever. And, you know, and we don't need any of these explanations to fully describe what it is. And it only distracts from the real work of actually trying to, at best, it distracts from the real work of trying to control the virus. And at worst, it can actually facilitate further spread and therefore increase deaths around the world.
I think there are probably many examples of this. And I think one of them dealt with measles death. One of the concerns that I had read about was that misinformation around measles, vaccines of measles.
Oh, yes. Well, indeed. I mean, God, that's well known. And it is a tragedy that, you know, even now there are children in Europe and North America who die each year because their parents believed fake evidence and fake science that they found on the internet and didn't have their children vaccinated.
Yes, so this is something that is, of course, a problem with the internet today mm-hmm. more than ever before, which is something that we will all have to deal with. Well, I thank you so much for being with us, Paul Hunter. It's been a great pleasure having you with us here on the Scholar Circle. Thank you for sharing your research and your
My pleasure. It's been lovely talking to you as well. Have a good day.
You too.
When we come back, we examine the flourishing of conspiracy theories. Stay tuned.
It's 2011. We're hoping that by the time 2000 rolls around, everyone will become knowledgeable. I want you and you and especially you to listen to me. Like many other black men,
welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Today's panel lays the foundations of the flourishing of conspiracy theories. Why do they flourish? How dangerous are they? Guest host Sam Smith speaks with two experts.
My name is Sam Smith, and today we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories. What are they? Are they dangerous? How do they develop? I'm joined in the studio by M. Dentith. He has a PhD from the University of Auckland and is an expert in the epistemology of conspiracy theories. He's also the author of The Philosophy of Conspiracy Theories. I'm also joined by Patrick Stokes. He's a senior lecturer in philosophy at Deakin University, and he's an expert in the ethics of conspiracy theories and has also written quite widely about this topic. So I'd like to start with you, Em. Could you give us a basic definition of what a conspiracy theory is?
So this is a definition which doesn't necessarily conform to ordinary usage, although I'll put a sidebar there. There's a question here as to whether there is an ordinary usage of this thing called conspiracy theory. But I define a conspiracy theory as any explanation of an event that cites a conspiracy as a salient cause.
What would you add to that, Pat?
I think that is probably the dominant definition in the epistemology literature on conspiracy theories. Others, and M knows this better than me, but others have tried to add extra bits and pieces. Like some people say it has to be for a morally disreputable purpose, or it has to be counter to an official narrative. So there have been attempts, but it's been paired right back to that very, very formal definition, which raises the worry for some of us, well, for me, that we maybe aren't quite getting with that definition at exactly what people talk about in the street when they say conspiracy theory. So there's an interesting tension there between a revisionary definition, if you like, that's really usable in philosophy versus a really messy, probably non-definition that the average person uses.
Do all conspiracies fall under one definition, or are there quite a few different types of definitions?
I think there's a number of different types. They probably all do fall under that definition just because it is so kind of capacious. There are different kinds. I've made the distinction between, for instance, conspiracy theories that are born conspiratorial. So they start by looking at an event and saying, this is the result of a conspiracy. On the other hand, there are some theories that become conspiratorial as a result of trying to defend theory, for instance. So they may not be a conspiracy theory, but then when other evidence comes in, they'll say, oh, well, the reason that, you know, the theory looks bad is because somebody's working to cover this up.
Would you agree with that, Em?
Yes. I mean, I think the problem when we're talking about these things called conspiracy theories is that there are a lot of things which are called conspiracy theories, some of which aren't even theories about conspiracies. So Jesse Walker, who's a contributor to the Joe Usinski book, Conspiracy Theories and the People Who Believe Them, points out that after MH17 disappeared, one media organization listed 10 weird conspiracy theories about the disappearance of that Malaysian airline, including it was swallowed by a black hole. And as he pointed out, black holes are not conspiratorial. It's just a weird belief. But often when we talk about conspiracy theories, there's a conflation between theories which are about conspiratorial activity and stories that we just take to be false or unlikely. So it's very hard to kind of narrow down what the ordinary usage of conspiracy theory is, which is kind of why I go for this kind of capacious definition of conspiracy theory, because I think it's the most useful one for the analysis of theories about conspiracies, even if it doesn't necessarily map on to how the ordinary language user talks about things called conspiracy theories.
So how do conspiracy theories begin exactly, and how is it that some manage to survive over time while others kind of disappear?
Well, so there are kind of two dominant discourses that will explain this. So you'll get what we call the generalist position, which will put down conspiracy theories to some kind of epistemic or psychological pathology. So they're malformed beliefs by people interacting with the world and coming to the wrong conclusions, at which point conspiracy theories are almost always likely to be false by this particular kind of view. And because of that, they're formed in malformed ways, and it can be all sorts of reasons, whether it be you're psychologically conditioned to see conspiracies where they aren't, you have an epistemic fault where you infer the existence of a conspiracy without considering competing explanations and the like. And then you get what's called the particularist position, which is kind of dominant in those of us who do the philosophy of conspiracy theory, that go, well, look, conspiracy theories often form with relation to evidence, and sometimes they're malformed and sometimes they're well-formed. And so you need to look at what evidence people put forward and what kind of assumptions they're operating with. So, I mean, I spent a year and a half working in Romania. Romania is a very corrupt political space. They have an openly corrupt government. Romanians suspect conspiracies are behind an awful lot of things that go on in the Romanian political sphere. So they suspect conspiracies because conspiracy is normal in that space. Well, Pat and I come from a much more benign political space, or though maybe Aotearoa New Zealand's a lot more benign than Australia is at this particular point in time. And so we kind of think of conspiracies as being relatively rare in our political situation, and thus we're less likely to assume that that's a kind of a primary cause for events in our political space.
What would you add to that, Pat?
One thing that's worth noting about the etiology of conspiracy theory, Em's quite right, in some ways it is going to come down to how conspired you take your body politic to be. And that's going to a certain extent license how reasonable any of these beliefs are going to be. But it's also noticeable that a lot of them seem to follow predefined sort of narratives or predefined sort of structures for what you think explains a certain kind of action. So if you look, for instance, at a thing that happens anytime there's a sort of a mass casualty event in the US, there'll almost instantly be some move to declare that it's some sort of false flag exercise, that either it didn't really happen, which doesn't make it a false flag, it makes it something else, or it did happen, but it was the government who perpetrated it. And that's a very, very common, if you like, trope, and the same kind of explanatory trope or explanatory picture keeps being redeployed in different contexts. So in some ways, when we look at the origins of these theories, we also have to look at the way in which there's a social practice, if you like, that's being appealed to. And that social practice will differ according to different contexts. So it may look very different in a avowedly corrupt society where conspiracies turn out to be happening all the time compared to a more transparent sort of society. I have in the past, and I know this is kind of perhaps buying into it, the pathologizing view, which people don't necessarily like, but I have in the past sometimes said in some ways conspiracy theories, when they become kind of excessive or you know, frequently happening, are something kind of analogous to hypochondria rather than an illness itself, where you're just kind of seeing every signal that comes out of the body politic as sinister. Everything is meaningful and everything is sinister. So there's no noise, it's all signal, and everything has some dark meaning behind it. So in some ways, quite analogous to what happens to the hypochondriac, where their body has become opaque to themselves. Every single thing that happens is clearly meaningful and it clearly portends disaster. So there's interesting things to be said about the etiology of conspiracy theories, which in some ways sit awkwardly with what, as philosophers, we might want to do, which is just try and come up with a nice, clear definition and see how rational that definition is.
I'd like to turn to the role of the internet and the media in sort of contributing to the rise of conspiracy theories and culture. How has the internet contributed, firstly, to the rise of conspiracy theory culture? Very recently, we've heard a lot about 8chan and 4chan, for example.
So the internet plays, I think, a fairly important role with why we talk about conspiracy theories. So what I'm going to say now is contentious amongst conspiracy theory scholars. There was a book that came out in 2014 called American Conspiracy Theories, written by Joe Usinski and Joe Parent. And they looked at a whole bunch of letters to the editor in newspapers in the US over the 20th century, trying to map as to when the peak of conspiracy theorizing was going on in US discourse. And they kind of say, well, look, the 1960s is the peak of when people were talking about conspiracy theories. And actually, conspiracy theories have been in steady decline ever since. And of course, this ends up being contentious amongst scholars of conspiracy theory because anecdotally, conspiracy theories look really, really popular at the moment. And Usinski and Parent go, well, that might just be a reporting thing. Because conspiracy theories are even more rare than usual, they actually end up being more notable. And so the media reports on them more, and thus we hear about them more. In the same respect, there's been a general decline in criminal activity in Western nations over the latter part of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, which has conversely led to increased reporting of crime because crime is more notable. So there is a question here as to whether conspiracy theories are the big issue they appear to be. But they certainly are very easily spread because in the old days, and the old days is back in the 1960s or so, if you had a conspiracy theory and you wanted people to learn about it, you'd have to write a letter to the editor in a magazine, publish an article in a magazine, or write a book. And then you'd have to wait for people to read that material. Then you'd have to wait for people to reply to that material. And then you might engage in a really, really prolonged discussion of that material for years and years and years. Now, if I were to, say, put a conspiracy theory up on my blog, I would have people responding to it within hours, if not minutes, of the post going up. And so there's been a kind of weird focusing effect we're seeing with the internet. It's very easy to find out about conspiracy theories now.
Pat?
I'd add to that too that not only is it easy to find out about conspiracy theory, but with any kind of countercultural or counter-consensus belief of any sort, it's much, much easier to find your people now, right? It's much, much easier to find a community of people who believe the same things you do or are at least inclined to go down the same kind of pathways, which means that it's much easier to sustain these sorts of views because there's people around you who are prepared to constitute what M would call a community of inquiry, taking a term from the pragmatists, who do actually explore and investigate these ideas, but also give you some validation, if you like, and make it much easier to maintain that sort of belief. So there's a point about speed of dissemination of conspiracy theory, but there's also a point about the way in which epistemic communities can arise that can reinforce these beliefs amongst each other. So, I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory, although it maybe generates conspiracy theory, but something like flat earth belief, which is kind of the shorthand now for, you know, irrational belief or whatever, that not only is much easier to disseminate now, but it's also much, much easier to build a community of people and say, well, okay, maybe this is a rational thing to believe because so many of the people around me seem to entertain it as a serious view. It's much easier to form those communities now.
How dangerous can it be for a conspiracy theory to flourish and the culture around certain conspiracy theories?
Depends by what you mean by dangerous. There's two ways of looking at this. One is a consequentialist way, which is to say that conspiracy beliefs do often motivate people to do harmful sorts of things. We saw that with the Pizzagate controversy in the US not long ago, for instance, people actually, you know, bursting into restaurants with guns and things. The reply to that you can make, of course, is that in that conspiracy theories are neither a necessary nor sufficient condition for someone doing these sorts of things. Plenty of beliefs that are non-conspiratorial motivate people to do terrible things, and plenty of conspiracy theorists don't do terrible things. So there's that. I think in some ways conspiracy theory does make it easier to make accusations against people, for instance. So it's psychologically probably a bit easier to harass, say, a grieving parent by saying your child never really existed and you're a crisis actor. It's probably much easier to do that if you have a prior commitment to the world being a certain way and to a conspiracy as the best explanation for a certain kind of event. There's also, and this is somewhere where I know Em and I disagree, there's also a broader issue about whether conspiracy theory licenses accusation and whether simply accusing someone contains a certain kind of non-consequential moral wrong in itself. That is, if we have a duty to think well of people, does entertaining conspiracy theories make us more likely to conclude that people are not what they appear to be, or they're actually doing terrible things that they don't acknowledge doing?
What would you say to that, Em?
Yes, so Pat and I have had quite a discussion about this in the past, and actually part of that discussion goes on in a book we're both in, Taking Conspiracy Theories Seriously, edited by myself, published by Roman and Littlefield last year. Now, I think part of that can be mopped up by trying to assess what kind of society you're in. So once again, in the Australian Aotearoa New Zealand context, where conspiracies are, as far as we're concerned, relatively rare, maybe we do kind of have a duty to be trusting to one another all the time, or at least most of the time. Whilst if you're in a corrupt polity where your levels of trust are very, very low, or imagine growing up under the Stasi in Germany, a situation where you really can't trust that your neighbours are looking after you, then you will have a completely different attitude towards these things. And the ethics of passing how you talk about conspiracy will change depending on the culture or historical time you're in. I also think it's important to note that, yes, it is true, some conspiracy theorists do terrible things, and as Pat points out, that's because some people just do terrible things anyway, sometimes because of conspiracy theories, sometimes for other rationales. But also, conspiracy theorizing as a phenomena can also be a useful release valve in a democratic system, because we need to be aware that there could be conspiracies going on in our political system now. We know conspiracies have occurred. We need to be attentive to the idea that they could occur again. And normally we're pretty concerned if there's a political conspiracy, because that tends to mean that politicians are up to something that they don't want the public to know about. And the presumption there is because it's, if not suspicious activity, sorry, if not sinister activity, it could be actually suspicious activity that needs to be checked nonetheless. So, I mean, there are negative consequences to belief in conspiracy theories, but there are also positive social consequences as well.
Anything there you want to pick up on, Pat?
There's a flip side to that too that's sometimes been noted is that while there's probably, you may say that part of what we need in any sort of healthy polity is a kind of standing distrust of power, a standing suspicion of power. And I think that's true. But it's also worth noting that looking for conspiracies can make us try and interpret events in terms of deliberate agency on the part of powerful actors, right, can make us look at these things and say, these people are deliberately and consciously trying to bring this about. And that can also then be in tension with the fact that very often we need to look at our societies in terms of how things happen that no one intends, but that are actually the result of institutional structures or forms of power where, you know, Foucault makes this point quite often, that power doesn't necessarily need projects. Power can sometimes just act on people and on things without anyone intending for things to come out a certain kind of way. So there is a kind of a tension there. You don't want to become, there's a distinction in literature, I can't think, remember who makes this, and we'll remember, but there's a distinction between institutional theorists and conspiracy theorists. So an institutional theorist will interpret everything as a result of impersonal institutional power forces. A conspiracy theorist might interpret everything in terms of individual agency. And the truth is almost certainly going to be a mix of those two things. You don't want to be blind to either of them.
I'd now like to talk about some specific examples of conspiracy theories, starting with, we've had obviously the Christchurch terrorist attack, and the internet kind of went wild with a lot of conspiracies. Pat mentioned false flags earlier. What have you seen, Em, around this issue?
So the afternoon of March 15th, I actually had a friend who was actually down in Christchurch, so I was sitting at my computer writing on conspiracy theories, got a text from my friend saying, I'm just near the mosque where the shootings occurred, which was the first time I heard about the shootings. Went online, almost immediately, because I'm used to looking for these things, found a 4chan thread about it, found a link to the manifesto, read the manifesto. I can talk about that publicly. I applied for an exemption to be able to hold a copy of the manifesto for research purposes. And suddenly we had this fully formed, within minutes of the event occurring, false flag hypothesis. People saying, well, I've watched the video and it looks as if it's staged, or it looks like it's, you know, it's using crisis actors of some particular kind. And yeah, this conspiracy theory emerged almost immediately. And I think that is part of what Pat's talking about here, about there being particular narratives. When you get a mass shooting, there is a certain class of person who thinks this event is so extraordinary that it must be fake in some sense, and immediately latch on to a kind of false flag mass shooting hypothesis, which then goes, well, if it's been faked, who could have faked it? Why was it faked? What's the rationale behind it? Which, of course, is then in tension with the actual manifesto of the shooter, which goes to very great lengths to talk about how long he took to plan the event and exactly what his motivation for the event was.
Pat, your response?
That event is an interesting one in the sense that this may be part of why false flags type conspiracies do occur so much now, or rather the accusation of them occurs. Maybe precisely because that was such a mediated event. I mean, obviously not for the people who were there for the tragedy, but it was an event that was increasingly, like other mass casualty events, is presented to us almost in a kind of, you know, heavily mediated sort of way where we can see things, but it's not, it's there, but it's not there. And that perhaps does lead people into this kind of distrust of spectacular society, which can lead people down that route. But also, again, as I say, if you're antecedently committed to the idea that false flag events happen and happen fairly routinely, that this is a thing that Western governments do, then it's going to be much easier to immediately interpret new surprising events and shocking events through that explanatory lens. Like you've already got, which we do with everything, right? When an event happens, we immediately have our kind of explanatory repertoires that we draw on to explain how this unexpected thing has come about. If a big part of your explanatory repertoire is the government acts behind the scenes and fakes this stuff, then it seems like that's going to be something that's going to be much easier to apply more or less automatically.
Some events through history have had led to some massive conspiracy theory industries around them, so to speak. I'm thinking here 9/11, truthers, the moon landing, John F. Kennedy's assassination. Why is it that events like these have taken on such a big mass industry scale, I guess, around them?
Some of it is due to the way in which governments responded. So one of the interesting things about the assassination of JFK and the aftermath was the formation of the Warren Commission, which produced the Warren Commission report, which was made of party political insiders that people were suspicious would be there to kind of cover things up rather than reveal details. They then produce a report, the Warren Commission report, which is a set of volumes with no index whatsoever, and all of the evidence kind of put in a fairly random hodgepodge manner, which then led people to go, well, what are they trying to hide by trying to confound us? Now, the reality is that no one actually thought the Warren Commission report would ever be read, so there was no need to have an index. There was no need to be systematic with the approach of putting all the evidence down. But it turned out that JFK was a beloved president. People wanted to know why exactly did this lone gunman do what he did. And so the report and the response to the assassination, even if it wasn't a conspiracy, looked like a cover-up of some kind. So I can kind of understand why people conspiracy theorize around JFK. And I can kind of also understand why it continues to be a big issue, because people don't feel it's been dealt with properly, although I would argue actually there's been several very good books that really do put the final nail in the coffin to show that Oswald really was the person who did the event. Things like the moon landing are slightly more interesting. I think in part because the growth of moon landing fakery stories don't really occur at the time the moon landing occurs. They really start to occur when we're not going to the moon anymore. And so there's this question of, well, we went to the moon, apparently. We're not going to the moon now. Was it all just an elaborate fake-out? So it's kind of post hoc reasoning, trying to explain why we appeared to have this really spectacular space program at one particular point in time, and yet now we've just left the moon alone.
What would you add to that, Pat?
The thing with JFK and also, say, Diana, right? So there's a whole bunch of conspiracy theories around the death of Princess Diana. Part of what's going on there too, I think, is that we just psychologically have a bias against the idea that big events can have mundane causes. And the thought that the president can be driving down the street and just get shot by a random guy from a window, or that, you know, the Princess of Wales can die just because of a drunk driver. Those sorts of thoughts somehow offend our sense of the proper scale on which causation should work. And so we do try to reach for more larger, more elaborate events. Government responses, as Em says, are also really important. I mean, in the case of JFK, some of the data that's come out fairly recently suggests there was actually a bit of a conspiracy going on there, but it wasn't to kill the president. It was basically the CIA and the FBI not wanting to come out that they did actually know quite a bit about Oswald, and they really should have been able to stop this. So that stuff's interesting. Also, yeah, with the moon landing as well, there's the interesting fact that not only is it something that we stopped doing, it's also the fact that it's something that the average person has no epistemic access to. I think the way conspiracy belief operates in some ways is going to be sociologically very interestingly connected to the increasing lack of connection that we have to, or that the average person has, to the knowledge-generating mechanisms of society. We went to the moon. How do we know? Well, here's a bunch of photos we took. You're just going to have to trust us. Human activity is causing massive climate change that threatens to destroy us all. How do we know? Well, we have to offload that to scientists because most of us can't simply work that out for ourselves. Increasingly, we have this thing about distributed knowledge, right? That the expertise and knowledge is distributed among experts, which means that for most people, you have to take this stuff on trust. And you've got maybe if you're more and more alienated from those knowledge-generating mechanisms, then you've got less and less reason to trust them, and more reason to see them as potentially being sinister or motivated against you. I think that's linked to it too.
Of course, not all conspiracies are overtly political. Some are kind of, I guess, more weird, or I guess they're quite fun to laugh at. I'm thinking people who are flat earthers or believe in the Illuminati or the 2012 Maya apocalypse idea. What do you make of some of those conspiracies?
Yeah, some of them are just kind of, they have the appearance of games. And sometimes they take off beyond that, right? So the Paul McCartney is dead one, right, which started in the late 60s. Again, started basically as a joke. And what you can do is you can take one of these premises and then it then becomes a fun sort of game to try and put as much evidence together as you can for that. The Germans have got a really good one. There's one particular town in Germany and it's like clearly this town doesn't exist because you don't know anyone has ever been there. And so there's all these kind of things like that. Well, the Australia doesn't exist one, which is a good one, actually, that Australia is a fake, which apparently circulated among some flat earthers. The thing is, of course, that those ideas can then connect with people who maybe have mental health issues or other problems as well. And they can actually go into some pretty dark places. So if you look into, for instance, the Paul McCartney is dead stuff, you pretty quickly stumble upon some websites that are disturbing or elusive, because of course these ideas can really resonate with people who might be in a bit of a dark place and can generate some stuff that's well outside the intended kind of fun spirit of the original theory.
Him?
Another thing to note about these things is that there's a difference between being a true believer in some conspiracy theory and being someone who is willing to entertain the conspiracy theory but not being committed to its truth. I mean, so it's fairly clear that for a period of time in the 20th century and the early 21st century, the Flat Earth Society was something you joined as a bit of a joke. It was one of those things, oh, I'm a flat earther. Do you believe the Earth is flat? Well, it could be, but people didn't really believe it. They were just entertaining the idea. And I think, as Pat points out, the Paul McCartney is dead thing started off as a bit of a joke, where it was a fun conspiracy theory to talk about because it allowed you to go, well, look, we actually know so little about Paul McCartney's personal life, and there are all these gaps in the story that suddenly you can fill those gaps by putting a hypothesis. But what if he died? And it turns out people have done the same thing with Britney Spears. They've done the same thing with Avril Lavigne. There are all of these conspiracy theories that X was replaced with Y at point blah for some rationale. And it's not clear that people are serious about these. They're simply entertaining them. And that's something we need to kind of remember when we talk about conspiracy theories, is that not every conspiracy theorist is committed to the truth of the conspiracy theory they espouse. Sometimes they're simply entertaining an idea because it might be true, but if you push them, they're not actually going to say, I absolutely believe it. On another point, the town in question is Beelford, and it turns out that when I was in Romania last, I met someone who allegedly went to the university there, although frankly I found her stories very, very implausible.
Now, both of you study conspiracies theories, obviously, but do either of you actually believe any conspiracy theories? So start with Pat.
I don't know. To be honest, the ones I'd be most likely to believe would be, I'd be most likely to believe the idea that it was someone other than Oswald, or that Oswald didn't act alone. That to me has a certain plausibility to it, but I don't necessarily think it's true. I can't think of any off the top of my head that I do believe, but I'm sure I suppose you could say there are ones that I believe that everyone accepts, all right? So the Gulf of Tonkin incident was bigged up to justify the invasion of Vietnam, for instance. Those sorts of things I think most of us kind of just accept. This is a point that some of our colleagues have made, which is that in a sense everyone's a conspiracy theorist because everyone believes that at least certain conspiracy events did actually happen.
Yeah.
I mean, my standard response here is I'm more interested in talking about the theory of conspiracy theory. I don't want people to think that I'm prejudging my conclusions by saying I believe X or Y. But yes, the shortcut to that is historical events, which were the result of conspiracy, Gulf of Tonkin, the assassination of Julius Caesar, the Moscow show trials, the Watergate affair. Depending on how you want to define things, the dodgy dossier motivation for the invasion of Iraq in 2003 all seem to be clear cases of cover-ups and collusion that led to events that were pejoratively labelled as conspiracy theories by people in power at the time, but turned out to be warranted on the evidence nonetheless. So in that particular respect, yes, there are a whole bunch of historical conspiracy theories that I'm quite willing to say, yes, those things really were beliefs that were resulting from conspiracies.
Final thoughts. Pat, what do you see as the future being like for conspiracy theory culture? Do you think it's going to continue to grow, or is it going to continue a decline, so to speak?
I think it probably will, just in the sense that there's been a definite kind of shift, or seems to have been a definite kind of shift, in terms of people's willingness to take on board certain kinds of epistemic authority which had previously been arrogated to other kind of knowledge-generating mechanisms. So what I mean by that is people are just much less inclined to believe what governments or universities or doctors tell them is the case. And in that context of this much greater kind of epistemic suspicion, I think it's quite likely that we'll continue to see conspiracy theories offered, because very often to sustain those sorts of beliefs, you have to posit the corruption of a lot of these very powerful actors. So I don't see them going away anytime soon. I think they're probably perennial, but I also think that the times suit conspiracy theories, to put it that way.
Final thoughts from you, Im.
Yeah, so I think part of the issue, of course, is that we currently have a leader of a world superpower who engages in conspiracy rhetoric all the time. So even if there was a kind of breakdown in general trust in the population over time, which may or may not be justified depending on the kind of information you have about the world in which you live, when you have someone in charge of the US, like Donald Trump, who engages in conspiracy talk a lot and uses that to energize and enrage the base, then conspiracy theories become a really big issue. And given that there is this angst in America at the moment, can we fix our political system and go back to how things used to be, which still had a fair amount of conspiracy talk in it, but it was polite conspiracy talk, so it was acceptable. We may well be stuck for the foreseeable future in a world where conspiracy theories are going to become a political tool that people use rather overtly. I mean, we're seeing that with Brexit in the UK. We're seeing the rise of that with populist governments in the EU. Arguably, it was a major part of the Australian election from just a week ago. It doesn't seem to be a major issue in Aotearoa New Zealand at the moment, but our election is still a year and a bit away, and we really don't know whether we're going to follow the leader or continue to be a little benign dot on the landscape.
Right. Well, thank you very much, both of you, Patrick Stokes and Im Denter. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure.
Im Denter is an expert in the epistemology of conspiracy theories. He's also the author of The Philosophy of Conspiracy Theories. Patrick Stokes is a senior lecturer in philosophy at Deakin University, and he's an expert in the ethics of conspiracy theories and has also written quite widely about this topic.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.